Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 96. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Zootopia, the latest film from Disney Animation. To help me talk about it on the show this week, we have Blaine Grimes from Real World Rewind and Reed Lackey from More Than One Lesson. These guys talk to me about animated films, all the things they loved about this movie, and the excellent reviews it's getting. We also talk about a film that wears its themes on its sleeve and how we're kind of okay with that. So we dive in, we examine some of the morals, some of the lessons that this film is pushing, and maybe question some of them, and maybe ask why more films can't do as well. So with that, we've also got a special time-sensitive announcement, which I typically don't do in the intros, but the People's Choice Podcast Awards are going to be very soon. The nominations close on April 30th as this podcast comes out. We have 10 days to try to get Real World Theology nominated, either in the TV and film or the religion and spirituality categories. So please, guys, go to podcastawards.com, and on the left-hand side, there is an option to nominate now, and please nominate Real World Theology. We appreciate you guys listening, and we appreciate you guys helping us out here. In the meantime, you can also go to realworldtheology.com for all our great content. You can subscribe to the podcast if you're not already through iTunes, Stitcher, FeedBurner. Look for new episodes on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month. Please review. Please tell people about the show. We love more people involved in the conversation. We love you involved in the conversation. So check out all the ways that you can do that. It's going to be a really great show for you. So here it is, episode 96, Zootopia and Following Your Dreams.
What I'm curious about, because, I mean, I guess, Reed, I've never had you on the show a lot to begin with, so I don't know where your particulars may lie with film. And Blaine, I've had you on, I think we just counted six times, and never for an animated movie. So I'm kind of curious what is your barometer when it comes to animated films, like Blaine? Like, do you love animated films? Do you catch them when someone tells you they're great? Do you catch as many as you can? Do you argue with people that they don't understand the medium and it's not just for kids? You know, like where does animation land on your radar?
Yeah, I love animated films. And part of it is because I grew up watching them like most kids do, but I never grew out of that. And since we're on a Lewis and Chesterton kick, there is, I believe it's in An Experiment in Criticism, Lewis says that part of growing older is growing out of the fear of being called foolish or being thought of as being foolish for liking childlike things. I'm butchering that quote. It's a lot more eloquent because Lewis said it, but it's something to that effect. And so I feel like I just never have, thankfully, for whatever reason, grown out of that. And I love animated films, and I think they're greatly undervalued. I mean, we just kind of tend to overlook them, and we think that maybe they are childish. I think especially in America, we maybe think that they're childish because we don't have some of the same iconic films that have shifted that perception like maybe they do in anime culture. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about films like Akira, Ghost in the Shell, that are geared distinctly towards adults. We don't have that as much, or we don't have a culture created around seminal films like that. And so I think it's just something we tend to ignore animated film or kind of push it to the side. But I think it's really rich and it's fun. There's nothing wrong with it being fun.
Well, no, I think that reminds me of two things. One is, I would say that's pretty similar to up until the last 5 years, and even in some exceptions. I remember thinking when I was younger that comic books were the same way. you read comics when you're a kid because you want dumb stories with pictures because you can't read a book without imagination type thing. And then it wasn't until I got to college and I had some comic book friends who really showed me, like, you really shouldn't grow out of comics because it's an amazing medium. It can explore all kinds of things that you are much harder to explore in live action, things like that. And the second thing is we did talk a lot about the tendency, I think especially of American culture. It's sort of like what you said, because I think it was on the Minions podcast, we went on that for a while, how parents especially kind of say, oh, it's animated, it must be for kids, so I'm going to take my kids and park them in front of it. I don't care what the lesson is. I don't care if it's really for adults. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter. It's a cartoon for kids. I'm grown up and I'm out of it. And I think that is a sad, sad thing, because
yeah. And to be fair, I mean, some films, I mean, that culture has been created and some films pander to that mm-hmm. tendency, and that doesn't help anything.
Yeah, with all genres, I would say.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So Reed, I'd ask you the same question. Like I said, I've only had the pleasure of having you on one episode so far, so I don't know where you stand with animation. Like, if it's something that, like I said, is it something that you catch a lot of, you really respect the genre, you go to it when you hear that it's great, you know, where does animation land on your radar?
Well, really all of that and more. I would think I've always been a fan of animated movies, even as a child, but even when I transitioned as a teenager and even as adult, if I were to express, which I won't in detail, but just for time's sake, but if I were to express, there are many, many years where my favorite film of the year happens to be an animated movie. Mm-hmm. And that's just where my tastes tend to lean. I feel like that animated films have a unique opportunity to dive into subjects in the same way that fantasy, sci-fi, and even sometimes the horror genre, though obviously with different frameworks, sometimes can get away with dealing with a tougher issue. They can get away with it because they're couched in something that, as you said, people automatically tend to dismiss as childish or fanciful. And so they have a little bit more of a sandbox to play in sometimes to really dive into things in a different way. I've always responded very strongly to that. Not to even further our literary pretentious natures, I think even going back to Aesop's Fables, where you have talking animals and it's automatic that these are not things based in tangible reality as we understand it, but the lessons behind it or the principles that they're exploring are very much grounded in tangible reality. And I think that animated films do that very effectively. And even more than that, you know, what Blaine said, they're fun. They can poke fun at a variety of different social issues. They can even poke fun at the family. A long standing favorite show of mine is The Simpsons. And I think Simpsons has done a phenomenal job, especially in the earliest seasons. We all know that they had a quality decline there for a while, but especially in the early seasons, they did a really great job of sort of skewering family and social dynamics in a very clever way. And obviously they've always been seen as, you know, a cartoon for adults. But it's just interesting to me. Like, I look at some of the stuff that Pixar has done, even early Disney, and it's just really potent stuff. It's potent storytelling. And so I've always been a huge fan of the genre.
Mm. Well, so we're here to talk about Zootopia, which we all saw for various reasons, mostly because none of us are opposed to animation, obviously. I won't go into my thing with it, because I've asked this, I think, on tons of podcasts and I've given my answer. So just go listen to our back episodes. But whenever it comes to animation, I know that it's typically aimed accessibly for children, even if it's something that adults can get a lot out of it too, like you mentioned Pixar and things like that. And when that happens, I find that I typically have a huge problem when movies wear their agendas on their sleeves. And this is where I look at you, Christian film. But for whatever reason, in Zootopia, I think Zootopia's agenda was worn on its sleeve and on its t-shirt and on a hat. And, you know, it was all over the film, unapologetic, and yet it still didn't take me out of the story. So, Blaine, I'm curious, did you feel similarly about kind of like the message or theme or even agenda, if you will, of the film. And if it didn't take you out of it, how did it accomplish that?
Yeah, so if I can answer that in a roundabout way.
Do it.
I think if you've been looking at anything I've done on Twitter and our Real World Theology Facebook group or anywhere, you know that I've loved Zootopia. And I've seen it 3 times now, not more, just because I haven't had the time to go see it more. but I will get there. So I love Zootopia. And I love it because I think it's a film that is almost everything that Frozen wanted to be and is not. It's relevant. It's socially conscious. It's smart. It's all of those things, and I can pair it a lot in my mind to Frozen because I think it succeeds exactly where Frozen fails on many counts.
Mm. Well, let me say, please send all your hate tweets to @DepartmentOfTourism.
Sorry, I'm forgetting the question.
Oh, gosh, that was my fault.
No, that's okay.
No, so did it take you out of the story in Zootopia?
Oh, no, it absolutely didn't take me out of the story at all, because the story is so compelling, right? And these elements, right, that even if they are on their shirt sleeves or hats or wherever, they're woven into the narrative so craftily and so well and so effectively that it never feels like a full stop or even slowing down, really, to preach at you. It never feels like it's preaching at you. The narrative is still rolling along. It's still dragging you in, still pulling you in, even as it's making social commentary all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it did it really, really effectively.
So expand on some of that social commentary. What would you say the biggest things that this movie wanted you to take away from it were?
Oh, where to start talking about this? So obviously this is a film that is about prejudice. But one of the really interesting things and important things, I think, to keep in mind is something that came out, or that I heard first in the documentary Imagining Zootopia, which is actually, you can watch it all on YouTube, legitimately and legally. You can watch it on YouTube. So check that out. It's about a 45-minute documentary. And there's a scene in there where all the filmmakers are sitting around the table and they're collaborating on the story and they're talking about story development. And someone, and I think it was John Lasseter, mentions that the questions this film needs to raise is not so much the question of, is prejudice or racism wrong? And he said, because that's like a 5-minute movie. That's what he said. He said, the question is, where does prejudice come from and how can we start to overcome it? And so I actually think it's helpful to sort of reframe maybe the way we think about Zootopia as something that's about whether racism is good or bad, because that should be, although it's quite obviously not in many circles, should be an easy question to answer. But it's helpful to think about, well, why is racism a problem and what can we do to overcome it? And I think it offers some really interesting and really compelling examples, but I don't want to take a lot of time away from Reed, so maybe we can have some back and forth.
Well, in that case, I'd ask Reed the same thing with what Blaine's framed with what, and I agree, you know, this movie is obviously head on tackling like prejudice, racism, probably classism, any kind of difference that we find between the person standing in your shoes and the person standing right next to you. I usually really don't want to think of my animated film as spoon feeding me something. And I feel like Zootopia should be getting that criticism, but it doesn't for some reason. So did it take you out of the movie, Reed?
I will have to say, sadly for me, it did, but that didn't mean that I didn't love the movie. I will say that if I were answering the question honestly, I did feel, I guess I should say, if someone were to come to me and say, I found Zootopia preachy, I probably wouldn't argue with them.
Okay.
But for me, it never really mattered. I think part of that was because of how on board I was with what it was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't ever feel preached at on Sunday morning when a pastor is speaking to me, because I am generally on board with whatever they're trying to tell me, even though the very definition of what they are doing is preaching at me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that when I don't intend to derail us by making this comparison, but you brought up Christian film. And I think that one of the problems that they have, or that the generalized genre, I'm definitely not going to classify every Christian film I've ever seen as this critique, but one of the generalized problems that I think Christian films have is that, you know, the distinction that Lasseter made is not whether or not something is wrong, but where does it come from? Mm-hmm. I think that that's a question that a lot of preachy films don't ask. They don't ask, what is this rooted in? They simply ask, you know, well, how should you feel about it? And I think that is something that is, to Zootopia's credit, is I feel like it tries to explore what is the root of some of these prejudices and whether or not they are legitimate. And even if they are legitimate, how do you not see them as a final verdict? And I think that's something that Zootopia tries very hard to stay beyond the line of, we're just going to preach at you that you shouldn't be prejudiced, and say instead, this is how it can arise, and it can arise from some valid factors, but there's something beyond this that we should be reaching towards, and we can do better. And I think that that's why people are probably not as prone to say, well, this is a very preachy film. I think because there's a sensibility to it that it is really trying not to be. And even though I feel like it walks, there's one moment in particular, I don't know if you want me to get into that specific moment now, but there's one moment in particular that I feel like, for me, again, I should clarify that for me, it didn't really cross the line, but if somebody were to come to me and say, well, this crossed the line into preachy territory, I wouldn't argue with them. And mm-hmm. that was the moment that Hobbes is giving the speech about there's a biological component. Mm-hmm. And the moment that she's giving the press release about there's a biological component, and you can see, you know, oh, should have written this down. For some reason, I'm blanking on the fox's name. But
Nick Wilde.
Yes. Yeah. So you can see the look on his face. You can see the effect that this statement is having on him, and that all felt so very. Like ripped out of the headlines. That felt so like this is an actual argument that I have heard outside of the realm mm-hmm. of fable, outside of the realm of metaphor and allegory. And then following it with a very effective montage of, you know, predators sitting on the subway, and then, you know, the herbivores moving away. And so when they were going through that process, that's when I said, okay, you're landing this blow pretty heavy. But they so rapidly went back to the relationship between Hobbes and Nick Wilde that I was like, okay, this is now we're back to story and back to character. So they didn't spend a ton of time on it, and I don't feel beat anybody over the head with it. So it did take me out for a minute, but not for long, and not for long enough for me to detriment the film for it.
Well, okay, go ahead, Blaine.
Oh, I was just going to say, I like the point you brought up, and I hadn't really thought about it this way. If somebody came to me and said, I thought Zootopia was preachy, I think I would agree with you, and I wouldn't argue with them about that. I think for me, when I tend to think of a film as preachy, maybe I define it in a little bit of a different way. So I typically think of a film as preachy when it's got one clear idea or message or moral that it's trying to get across, and it's going to force feed it down your throat. Because one of the things that good art does is it allows its audience, whatever the art is, to have some sort of experience with it and think about it on their own terms and kind of chew on it instead of just sort of delivering something, you know, like I said, straight down your throat via feeding tube. And so I typically think of a film that's preaching as doing that. And a lot of Christian films, I think, tend to be guilty of that type of preaching. And I think there's still enough built into Zootopia that allows the audience to sort of mull things over in their head and have sort of a more personal interaction with the film. So I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from. But I think that's absolutely valid. And I hadn't even thought about it in that light of, I can see where people would find it preachy. And find that distracting.
Well, I do like the idea that, well, I mean, both of you brought up about John Lasseter's quote or paraphrase. that preachy can be when you're trying to tell someone that something is right or wrong. You're not going to try to show them that it's right or wrong. You're not going to try to show where it comes from, to how it can be nuanced, you know, in the real world, and it has layers. It's just like, it would be a 5-minute film. You know, you have a guy, he punches another guy and see like, hey, isn't that wrong? Yeah, that's wrong. Short film, terrible short film. But but in this one, you know, you're talking about like the roots and how we could all easily be swayed into these things, and you can see how anyone would get there and how people aren't just the sum of their actions. Like, they have experiences and they have rationales that maybe got them to that place, and it's not as black and white as it would seem. And because of that, I think we need to do some real world, real talk, guys. Real talk. Does anyone else feel that Donald Trump needs to watch this movie?
Oh, man. If I thought he would pay more than, you know, 2 cents attention to it, then I'd make it mandatory. Yeah, absolutely.
It was terrible. I didn't like it. I didn't understand the bunnies with the hippity hoppity.
I would make a better movie, good point. And Mexico would pay for it.
Oh, man.
Well, I mean, so this film starts out with, you know, Judy Hopps saying, or at least getting us on her side, saying, it doesn't matter that I'm a bunny. I can be anything I want. Like, if I want it bad enough, society can't tell me what I can and can't do. And I would say, in general, that lines up with a lot of messages children's movies have. Like, you know, like, your dreams can come true. You just wish upon a star. Or if you try hard enough, you'll overcome. Don't give up. The little engine that could, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But is there a danger in this kind of message in a film like this with the current political and social climate? I mean, like, I don't want to, like, you know, squash the American dream, but it's bigger than that. It's about identity. Like, can people really be anything they want?
Well, unless Blaine had a burning answer, I'll tackle that one.
Go ahead.
So I think that there is an undercurrent to that thought that I do think is detrimental. I don't think that the thought on its surface of saying, well, you can be anything you want to be, I think actually there's a lot to explore with that biblically, spiritually. I think there's a tremendous quality to that. The fact that David could go from being a shepherd boy to being the king, mm-hmm. Is the earliest example I can think of, but that's definitely something for which God does, is call the nobody out and make them very vital to what he's doing
all the time
with his people. So I think that's true, but I think that the undercurrent that does need to be challenged is the inherent thought, and please correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm off base here, but I think there's when most people say it, they have a tendency to feel, I am entitled to something purely by virtue of the fact that I want it. Because I want it, that is enough to entitle me to it. And I think that is a dangerous idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea that you can be, that you are not purely defined by the restrictions into which you were born, is actually a very gospel-centric message, that you were not, I mean, by the very fact that we are born into a sinful nature, yet Christ sets us free from that. That's something that you could extend to a variety of different places to say, like, you know, where you were born into does not have to be the end of your story. I think that's absolutely relevant and vital, and something that Christians should really get behind. But if we take that to that place of, hey, I can do whatever I want, and I want this thing because I'm entitled to it. You know, going back to David, that's the Bathsheba. That's the, I want this, I'm going to have this, and I'm mm-hmm. going to break all kinds of laws and rules that it takes to acquire this thing. And that's definitely not something that we can step into. So I think as long as there is the hope and the dream of extending beyond what the world around us tells us we have to remain, that's definitely something I think that the scriptures encourage. I think that's something we as Christians should encourage. I think we should just always recognize with it that there is a humble heart that has to come with it, which says you have to recognize that that this is not about entitlement, that there is a gratefulness that must accompany this search that you come with it. And I hope that makes sense in the way I articulate it. But
no, I think that was great. Blaine, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I would second all of that, and I would also emphasize that I think Zootopia sort of complicates that idea too in an interesting way, that idea that we can be whatever we want to be. Because one of the things Zootopia explores is maybe sometimes the system or society itself is so broken that you can't, or that there are factors that make it very difficult for you to be what you want to be. And I think that's a really, frankly, smart and encouraging thing to see in an animated film.
Yeah.
Even though it's still obviously very optimistic in its answers and everything works out in the end, of course, because it's a Hollywood narrative. But yeah. But I still think it sort of sticks its toe in that water, if nothing else. And that's better than nothing. That's good, even.
Yeah, well, I guess it's making us have to pause at least to say, strokey beard. And I think if I could add, and I hope this isn't me co-opting and then putting it in a different direction, Reed, but because I liked everything you said, and I think that was, you hit exactly on what I was kind of, you know, leading the witness with. That, but I would say there can be a chasm of difference between what they want themselves to be and what Christ, as Christians at least, we have to think about what Christ wants us to be.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm purely looking at it from a feel-good, relatively moralistic, maybe even humanist kind of point of view, I say, why not? I've only got this life. As long as I'm not hurting anybody else, what's the problem with me wanting to be something greater than I am or different than I am? And I think that could become problematic. I like your depiction or your illustration of David, that the difference in what David wants, and what God wants for David are two different things. You know, David has the power to obtain Bathsheba, and so he does because it's what he wants. But then there's what God wants for him, which is to be a man after his own heart. And, you know, through various stories, we get both these pieces, but we see obviously which one is more fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
So just because I guess the movie is typically correct. I mean, I guess you can always be, or you can, you know, be anything you want, but maybe that's not always beneficial, which I guess is where Blaine's kind of saying they caged it a little bit. If I'm not misunderstanding you, Blaine.
Yeah, no, that's what, yeah.
So I would guess from here, I would ask a question about the actual thing while in the theater troubled me. Because, you know, I'm seeing most of the same things you guys are seeing. I'm seeing fights against prejudice, fights against, you know, social structures, things like that, that I think we could all get on board, like I said, morally, theologically, and things like that. But then I'm sitting there watching the end credits. And in case I didn't say we were going to spoil everything, we are going to spoil everything. I feel like there should be some kind of thing at the beginning I need to add to these podcasts to say, we're going to spoil this movie. but since I have it, we're going to spoil this movie. Not that this is a huge spoiler, but at the end, there's this concert, and the Shakira Gazelle is singing this song called Try Everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there, and I just turned to my wife, and I was like, should we try everything? Like, maybe I understand the spirit in which the song was being belted out, but I feel like there's maybe a little more nuance to it than try everything. Blaine, should we try everything?
Probably not. That's probably not a good practice. I'm just going to go with probably not. And I mean, hey, morally problematic songs are nothing new for Disney. I mean, just a few years ago, we had little girls everywhere and boys, I'm assuming, going around singing No Right, No Wrong, No Rules for Me, I'm Free.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, just so let this isn't go. Anything new.
It doesn't sound like you've let it go, Blaine.
I haven't let it go.
I'll be here all night.
I have not let it go. One, I love how Zootopia actually pokes fun on it at Frozen in there, because there's a line, this isn't some movie where you sing a song and your insipid dreams come true, so let it go. And I love that little sort of poking fun at Frozen in that way.
I hope everyone...
But yeah, don't try everything.
Okay, well, so why? So why should we not try everything? What's wrong? Like, this is Postrophe America. We have access to more things, and why shouldn't I try to do whatever I want? Like, what should I let people stop me, or is there maybe something else there?
Well, first of all, it's not apostrophe, it's hashtag America. You gotta hashtag. Get that right. Hashtag.
Oh, I wasn't this wasn't the Instagram speech. Version.
But so the Apostle Paul, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are edifying, right? Mm-hmm. All things are permissible, but not all things build up. As Christians, we are to focus on what is good and right and true, and noble. If anything's excellent or praiseworthy, we think on these things.
Yeah, but it sounds like
even if something we could try, that doesn't necessarily mean... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, that sounds like Christianese for don't do fun things. So,
it's totally not. It's totally not. I do fun things all the time.
And I'm a Christian.
I watch Zootopia. It's fun. but trying everything, right? If you want to take it that literally, try everything. Should we murder someone? Because that's trying everything, right? I mean,
well, how do we know if it goes in both? How do we know if it's bad directions. Until we try it, Blaine? So, come on.
I don't know. I'm just gonna have to. I'm just gonna have to I guess. Well, I guess maybe we do have to try.
So I think one thing that I would add to that whole conversation, and I have to preface this beforehand by saying that no, I am not a Shakira fan. Nothing wrong with Shakira. It's nothing wrong. But my wife and I took our son to see that movie. And I'll be honest, to my surprise, he didn't latch on to it very much. He was sort of drifting in his seat a little bit, getting a little fidgety. He was not as into it as I was kind of expecting him to be with talking animals. And maybe that was something of the heaviness of the plot. Mm-hmm. But one thing he absolutely latched on to was that song. To the point that when my wife was watching Dancing with the Stars and somebody danced to Try Everything, my son just very matter-of-factly gets up and begins to boogie down right in front of the TV, like begins to completely let everything go and just decide to be a slave to the rhythm. He was loving it. So I bring that up to say that I've actually listened to you know, verse and lyric and chorus of that song multiple times, just by virtue of the fact that he requests it every time we're driving to the store. And so, you know, I've heard it a lot. And I do think that the frame of the song is talking about not letting failure or the potential of failure keeping you from trying everything. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there is something in the overall thrust of the song that is not necessarily anarchistic, where it's like, you should try everything, you know, right. try yeah. drugs, kids, try premarital sex, you know, like none of that stuff, I think, is really the main impetus behind the song. I think it really is focused behind, you want to do this thing, but they say you're not going to be able to do it. You're not going to succeed. You're not going to, this is not the place for you. But you know what? Even though I could fail, I'm going to try this because I want to try that. You know, I want to try everything. And I think that when it's framed in that capacity of don't let failure keep you from trying, that's absolutely something I'm on board mm-hmm. with. That's mm-hmm. absolutely something that I would encourage my son to buy into, that I would like to buy into more of myself, because as I get more into adulthood, I'm terrified of everything. And so I would really love to be more bold in a variety of ways. So I think in that respect, I'm definitely on board with the song, although like you guys, I would temper any of the thoughts about, oh, we should just do whatever we want.
Yeah.
That's not something that I'm on board with. But I do think in terms of, I would love something that I would say about Zootopia in a broad spectrum is I think I enjoyed it immensely, but more than I enjoyed it, I remember walking out of the theater going, I'm glad my son has this movie. Like, I'm glad he's going to grow up and that this movie's going to be around. Maybe that's giving the film more weight and credit than it should or than it deserves. But I remember thinking, because of its overall messages, I remember thinking, like, I'm just really glad that my son's 4 years old. He's going to grow up and, you know, maybe he won't ever like the film, or maybe it won't be among his favorites. But I'm just glad it's there.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, yeah. And I think between me probably verily playing devil's advocate to Blaine and kind of you kind of bringing it home there, Reed, I think that's how I felt having just watched the entire movie. The Try Everything song completely fit. I was like, I'm pretty sure I know what we're going for here. I'm totally on board with that. I think you shouldn't let people tell you that you can't, that failure is the reason to stop doing something or to not try something. But I feel like it's kind of like that frozen fever, you know, people just belting out like Let It Go or, you know, whatever Disney song. And I'm like, wow, that's, you know, out of the context of the film or just out of context in general, like that's a harsh chorus that maybe needs to have a little nuance to it. And so, yeah, I remember, like I said, when I turned to my wife, I was like, okay, yeah, I get it. Like, based on what the film's trying to say, I get it. But when, you know, when kids are riding to the supermarket and just wanting to listen to it, like, what are they hearing, you know? Like, if they didn't really pick up on everything in the film and all that's going through their head is try everything, try everything, try everything, you know, that's tough, because it's that's that line where what are children getting and what should be children getting? So,
and I think even the context in which the song first occurs, because it first occurs on her train ride into Zootopia, is really important. It's when she's moving away from the country into the city. And so it's like she's experiencing this whole new world and becoming a bunny officer and all of these things. So she's trying everything in a very hyperbolic sense. I mean, it's hyperbole. Mm-hmm. So I think anybody who would want to get on too big of a moral rant against this song, I don't think it really works in the context of the film.
Well, I
think it's a much better single for a film than not to pick on Frozen, but then Frozen again.
Well, I just know some internet chat groups that would probably go crazy because of this song, and its possible out of context moral implications. I'm not going to say any names, but I know there are such internet chat groups.
They exist.
Well, okay. So I want to.
But I mean, out of context, there are passages in the Bible that, you know, people would go crazy over. So
no, that doesn't sound right.
It's very important.
That doesn't sound right.
Blaine, you're using a little thing like called your brain, and I need you to stop because that has no place here. Okay.
Not in our Bible talk.
No.
Well, I want to shift gears slightly to talk about something else that just jumped out at me, and it jumped out at me again, not just because it was a hippity hoppity character that was saying it, but because it seemed like at this point, at a certain point in the film, I was supposed to be on a page, and when someone said something, the film expected me to be like, oh no, that's not right. And I was kind of like, yeah, that's not right in the context of the film, but that's kind of right. And that happened when it's something that Reed actually mentioned. It's when Nick gets offended when Judy gets up to the podium and she, not really understanding what's going on, kind of admits that there might be some kind of biological component to the predators going crazy. And she kind of insinuates or flat out states, again, from her perspective at the time, that, you know, it might be something that animals can't escape no matter how evolved they are. And so, in the context of the story, you know, I was like, oh, I can't believe she's saying that. Didn't she just talk to Nick? You know, she just gave him the application. They're going to be best buds. We're over this, right? We realize it's not something you can't evolve out of. But then if I take this for the metaphor that it's supposed to be, right? This is supposed to be about prejudice. This is supposed to be about who we are and what we can be and what we can't escape. I have to kind of say, well, maybe, you know, she's accidentally right. It's like Mr. Big says, you know, we may be evolved, but deep down we're still animals. And I would say in this particular case, no matter how much humanity evolves, we're still going to be sinning. We're still going to have that sin nature, at least the way we see it. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's something that, the fight against nature is like our own personal natures is something that I think is often poorly handled in the conversation, because I think people use nature, your natural tendencies. Let me stop saying nature. Like your natural tendencies, people use those to compartmentalize you, to categorize you, and they use them ultimately to dismiss you. And I think that when we're dealing with our own sin, we could do the same thing. Well, I just have this proclivity. Sometimes in our own minds, we will self-justify that way. This is just what I have a proclivity to do. So I'm not even going to try to be better or to make stronger choices or to try to overcome it. I'm not even going to try because I have this very natural proclivity to do this. And I think that it can be troublesome when we try to swing the pendulum to the whole other side, which is what I think happens. I have to admit that I'm a little reticent to make the statement I'm about to make, but I'm just going to make it and hope that that people hear it in the spirit in which it's given, which is exploring this idea. I think that the pendulum can sometimes swing the other direction, in which, because of how categories and compartmentalizing people has been severely abused by a variety of people, we've now come to say, like, well, categories are wrong and categories are bad. Categories are actually neutral. There's nothing inherently wrong about categorizing anybody, whether it be by race or gender or anything else. What is wrong, in my estimation of it, as I understand the heart of Christ for people, is what is wrong is to say, because you are in this category ultimately defines you, and you will never be anything more than the stereotypical norm of this category. And I think that's where we tend to buck against that trend so much, and culture bucks against it so much, to the degree that they say something that personally I really abhor, and that's the statement, live your truth, where people will say, just, you know, you define truth. You define what it is that is truth to you, which I think, as respectfully and tastefully as I can say this, is utter nonsense. But that's the backlash against this categorizing of people, is to say, like, well, because there's a biological component to predators, that we think that that's part of why, and they'll never rise above that. What she is stating is not offensive. The implication behind the statement is what is dangerous, and that implication is that all predators are only going to be this thing. Mm-hmm. And we'll do the same thing with men. We'll do the same thing with women. We'll do the same thing with races, where we'll say all of this race. I mean, you referenced him earlier, so I'm just going to say he's fair game. I won't say who said this, but the prominent politician who categorizes, you know, a group of immigrants as as all being bad. Mm-hmm. He's making that implication. He's making that implication, and I see other people on social media or even in conversation begin to make the same implication, where it's like, well, because the 23 incidences in the last 15 years have all been perpetrated by this group of people, you know, therefore it must mean that all of this group of people are simply waiting with bated breath to perpetrate acts of similar nature. Mm-hmm. That is categorically wrong. That's absolutely a wrong idea. And I think it's an idea that Christ's life on earth completely contradicts the amount of people that were absolutely unacceptable for Jews to associate with, and that were absolutely unacceptable for Jews to bless and to speak with. He went about the business of finding these people and blessing them. And I think that just speaks to the idea that we have to kill the notion that people are defined by their categories as, you know, ultimate verdicts. And I think once we can kill that notion, we'll feel freer to categorize people, because we know, like, hey, it does not matter that this person is of this other race. I can say this person is of this other race, and the fact that they are in equal standing to me, it doesn't matter. It doesn't make a difference. They have this heritage, I have this heritage, but we stand together, or we break bread together, or we eat in the same house, or we work at the same job, and it doesn't matter. I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I would second all of that. I mean, if you even think about the woman in the woman of Samaria. She's a Samaritan who Jesus had no business. I mean, Jews had no business associating with Samaritans. You know, they went out of their way to get around them. They didn't talk to Samaritans. And then she's a woman, and he's spending time with a woman, which of course at the time was just unthinkable. So she's a Samaritan woman, and these are the people that Christ seeks out, right? He seeks out the lowly, right?
Mm-hmm.
The lost,
the marginalized.
And even think about the church. The church is a people made up of every tribe, tongue, and nation. That's what Revelation says.
Absolutely.
Even the old division between Jews and Gentiles, the division has been, the wall has been torn, and the two groups are made one. There's unity in Christ. And
well,
I will say, though, I guess for what you're thinking of in terms of the film, Mikey, I would say that maybe one weakness is there are times when that metaphor, that analogy doesn't really come through maybe as well as it could have, and that could be one instance where it's a little bit more difficult to parse.
Yeah, I think there you can have both sides to it. Like I said, I think specifically in the context of the film, if you're only looking at it from a story perspective, it seems silly that she would think this. If you think of it as a metaphor, I think it starts to break down. Because I think it as a metaphor, it is trying to say that people can't overcome the things that are biologically, historically themselves.
Mm.
And they're showing it in such a way that, you know, this is one of the few times that Judy Hopps kind of looks foolish, at least to us as an audience. It's when she suggests that someone's history or how they were born or the place where, you know, their lineage has some kind of stake on what they're going to be in the future. Mm-hmm. And like I said, if as a metaphor, it's supposed to make us think that idea is ancient and outdated and dumb and simple-minded. And I don't think it is. Not totally. Now, like I said, in the context of the film, I think obviously I'm on board with it not being the case. In the context of the metaphor, I'm mostly on board with it not being the case. As we've already talked about, you know, like there are things, you know, we shouldn't let failure stop us from being more than we have. You know, David went from, you know, being like nothing to being a king. Like it's not that kind of thing where your biology can't do it, but it's the fact that we're still humans. We still have a sin nature. We talked about this a lot in The Big Short. You know, is there going to be another financial crisis? Yes. You know why? Because we're always going to be greedy. There's nothing, like, humans are going to be greedy. We're going to be full of pride, and we're going to think that we can't fail. And without that in check, we find that's our goal, that's our identity. We're putting our hope in something besides Christ. Like, the end is ruin. And that's unfortunately in us. And no matter how many promotions I get, no matter, you know, how hard I work, I'm always going to have that in me. Now, like I said, thankfully we can as Christians look at that and say, that won't be on my final tally when all's said and done, because I have a Savior that has washed that away. But as far as my actions on earth, it's not something I can escape. I can't evolve out of it. Nature isn't going to let me evolve out of it. My own works and accomplishment are not going to let me walk out of it. And it's where I love what both of you guys said when it comes to categorizing. I think I can, without nuancing it too much, or without having nuanced it too much, Reed, I think I can get on board with what you're saying about categories being neutral. And Blaine, I think when you added something to it, I think it points out that something that the only category that really matters, the only category that sits above other categories, is the category of us being in Christ. Other than that, all the categories are like, you know, the church is made up of everybody. The church is made up of this color person and that color person and the person that makes this much money and a person that makes this much money and a person that lives in this country and a person that lives in this country and a person that votes for this person and a person that votes for this person and et cetera and et cetera and et cetera. And none of that makes us better category than another category.
Right.
The only category that elevates above any category is the category of being in Christ. Because honestly, it's the only category that truly can define you. Everything else is a false identity.
Yeah.
This rant has been brought to you by Mikey.
Amen.
Well, okay, so maybe my rant went so long that I didn't get it. I've already answered this next question, but I do want to talk about two aspects of this last question that I had for you guys. And one is how it made you feel, and two is, does it work in the larger metaphor? And that's, you know, Zootopia's opening premise is one that I couldn't get on board with necessarily. It's the one that the animals have evolved into a society that's more enlightened, and once they get to a certain level of enlightenment, everyone will be walking hand in hand in peace, and Zootopia is a utopia. But I like the fact that at the end, they come to this conclusion through Judy's final voiceover that, I'll just read it because I've been talking forever anyway, so everyone's used to my voice, that she says, I thought this city would be the perfect place where everyone got along and anyone could be anything. Turns out, life's a little more complicated than a slogan on a bumper sticker. Real life is messy. We all have limitations. We all make mistakes, which means, hey, glass half full. We have a lot in common, and the more we try to understand one another, the more exceptional each one of us will be. But we have to try. So no matter what kind of person you are, I implore you, try. Try to make the world a better place. Look inside yourself and recognize that change starts with you. So I like the idea of where this ends the film, that no matter how hard people or animals try, no matter how enlightened they become, they're never going to be a perfect society. But there's still something that doesn't sit right with me. But to stop talking, I'm going to ask Blaine how this speech, kind of wrapping up the film, sat with you.
So actually, it's funny you bring that up. I on the list of, you always ask, you know, what do we like, what was our come on moment?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had the speech at the end as my come on moment, mm-hmm. even though there's some really great lines in there. I'm just not a huge fan personally of speeches, big heroic speeches at the end of animated family films. So I could have done with that without that as good as some of the lines were. Can I answer that in a slightly different way and go on my own mini rant?
Please do. Rant away.
So I think we talked a lot about what's on the surface and what's really just kind of right there for us, right for the picking in this movie. But I do think it's a really smart movie, and it's doing some things really subtly that maybe aren't as obvious on the nose. So for instance, Zootopia obviously makes a lot of nods to other films, right? There's the Breaking Bad line in there. There's the reference, as I already mentioned, to Frozen, and it even has the movie covers by the guy who's selling the bootlegs there. So it makes a lot of nods to other films. So in particular, Zootopia pays homage to film noir in a really smart and I think effective way. And so to stop and give you a little bit of background, film noir was a distinctly American style of filmmaking that was popular in the 1940s and 1950s. So it emerged out of a World War II and really especially a post-World War II American culture. And noir films are typically characterized by, among several other things, a really bleak style and tone. They usually have a deep mistrust of authority as a theme or a motif throughout their films. And I think this is most relevant to Zootopia, they have a really pessimistic outlook on life. They're typically not happy films, right? Film noir films are not happy. And so in part, film noir, at least in terms of its anxiety, especially about things like femininity and female power. And so to bring things full circle back around to Zootopia, I think Zootopia interacts with this narrative in a really smart way. Because what it does is it takes a filmmaking style, film noir, right? You've got these characters, Judy Hopps and Nick Wilde, they're detectives, right? There's even shots that are very low-key in terms of lighting, which is a direct nod to film noir. They've got she's got the detective hat on, right? There's sleuthing. There's this big mob boss. It's got all these nods to film noir. So it takes this style that is known for a negative and bleak response, a pessimistic response to social issues, and then refuses to succumb to that pessimism. It's a very, very optimistic film, even as it deals with contemporary social issues like prejudice. Instead of wallowing sort of in nihilism or in just surrendering itself to pessimism, it's actually very, very optimistic about the ability to reverse these problems. And I think does that in a really, really smart way. So not every single thing is on the nose. I think it's really successful in a lot of ways that maybe we don't give it credit for. Mm. Also, just on a sort of unrelated note, it's successful in that it doesn't succumb to, it's able to do things other than make fart jokes. So it's not like this movie is completely devoid of bodily humor, right? There's the whole nudist colony and all that stuff. But the restraint with which it uses those kinds of things, especially if you compare it with our films, similar films, that's a sign of really, really mature filmmaking. And I'm glad that it's able to do something that it's able to be that restrained, especially when it's primarily targeted toward a younger audience. One more thing, and then I promise I'll end the rant. But I loved this about the movie. This is the part that almost brings me to tears every time. And admittedly, I cry a little bit easy in movies. But it's also a film that shows characters who are willing to change and admit that they're wrong. So after the scene that we've talked about, where Judy, you know, says this thing and she offends everybody, sort of breaks the city, and there's fear running rampant. She eventually does. She comes around and she repents, basically, right? I mean, this film comes very close to showing what it looks like to actually repent in a biblical sense. Very close. She understands that she was ignorant, that she was hurtful. She feels genuine remorse. And she knows that she was wrong. She's willing to accept responsibility. And she even says, you know, you have every right to hate me. I'm not saying that you don't have that right. I'm saying I need your help. And I think that is something that a lot of animated films, a lot of Disney animated films don't do. Right. I mean, I know I'm picking on this movie. Let's go back to Frozen. You got this protagonist, the Ice Queen one, right? You got this Ice Queen who never changes throughout the entire movie. And there's never even a scene in there where she's like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe no right, no wrong, no rules for me isn't the best way to live. But Zootopia doesn't do that. It actually shows characters who are dynamic and who change and have some depth to them.
And like I said, I keep vacillating between these two things. Like, is it being so optimistic that it's actually making things sound more simple than they should be? Or is it being optimistic to kind of keep you in it and realize that these characters are real and trying to make a difference? And that in and of itself should make you think about it more, which again is hopefully tying back into the idea that being evolved isn't enough in and of itself. Like, there needs to be something that you do. And I also like the fact that you're pointing out, which is what I was hoping to get to as well, that there are things that Judy says in her final speech that are good. But there are some things that aren't so good. And now that Blaine has gone on his rant, I give you the same chance, Reed. So, I mean, and so in the context of obviously being able to respond to anything that, that Blaine threw out there, a bunch of good stuff that,
sure.
The context of a question being like, how did that final speech sit with you? Or how did it wrap up the film for you?
Well, what's interesting is, as I was listening to Blaine, I hadn't really thought about it in this context. So I'm going to have to maybe do a preliminary and possibly, hopefully, unnecessary apology. My thoughts may be a bit scattered here, but as Blaine was talking, I was thinking, you know what, a possible parent or ancestral film to Zootopia might be In the Heat of the Night. Have you guys ever seen In the Heat of the Night?
I know I've seen it only because I remember the theme song.
That's funny. Well, I actually don't think that, I don't know if the film, I would have to rewatch it. I don't know if the film had the theme song from the TV show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know. It might. I don't remember.
Probably not.
But, you know, there's no need to go off on this long tangent about In the Heat of the Night because that's not the film we're talking about. But it deals with some similar themes where, you know, the character Virgil Tibbs, played by Sidney Poitier, is I think he's just traveling through town, but there's been a murder in this very small southern town, and because he is passing through and because he is a black man, they take him into custody as a suspect. It's a very racially charged film, but he himself is a detective, a very high profile one from where he's from, and I forget what city he's from. And so he winds up helping them on the investigation, and the film deals with, you know, similar themes as Zootopia does about not racially categorizing a person, not racially valuing them. And then obviously with Zootopia, we're not talking about races per se, but that's the extension of the metaphor that they're going for. And it did not have, and this is the reason that I bring it up now, is because it In the Heat of the Night did not have a similar speech at the end. It simply ended. And I, in the moment, coming out of Zootopia, I didn't really mind that speech. I remember it was during that speech that I first had the thought that I think I referenced earlier, where I was sitting in the theater, my son's kind of fidgeting a little bit, and my wife and I are sitting there, and I remember just thinking, like, I'm glad this is here. Like, I'm glad that this movie has been made and that my son can watch it, and maybe it will give me some opportunity in which to articulate this idea in a very tangible way for him. And so in that respect, I did like the speech. I did feel like it was on the nose, but I didn't, again, as with most of the film's themes and the choices it chooses to make in its narrative, it didn't bother me. The fact that it was so on the nose never really disturbed me or hampered my enjoyment of the film. So I would say I felt good about the fact that it was there. I definitely agree with the generalized sentiment that we should try to do better. But I think I don't know, I'm a little conflicted about it, because as a Christian, I kind of have an understanding that we, in my theological understanding, we're not going to get better without help. That without surrendering our lives to Christ, we're not going to really have a hope of making the kind of choices we need to make to bring us together in unity, to where we can be not conformed to one another, but unified, to where we are actually, we maintain our distinct characteristics, yet we're one body. And I'm definitely on board for that notion, and obviously Zootopia is not going to qualify its message about trying to do better by saying, like, remember, it's got to be in the context of a surrendered relationship to Jesus Christ. You know, like, they're not going to do that. So I think that's, you know, in terms of the thrust behind what they're trying to say, honestly, I find myself feeling that way when I have conversations with people about political issues and social issues. I'll be the first to say, I don't know that I have the answers to the problems that face us, but I know that we should be striving for something beyond where we're striving, that right now we're just kind of taking the apples and oranges on hand. We're not even looking at the tree that they came from and asking, you know, what's the root behind this, and how do we cultivate more trees to get more fruit? We don't even ask those kind of questions. We're just like, do you like apples or oranges? You got to pick one and pick it now. And, you know, the rest of them have to go away or have to, you know, be categorized over in this other place. So I agree with the notion of we got to try to do better. We have to reach for something like Paul talks about pressing on. You know, he's talking about running the race of faith. But I think that effort towards trying to make better choices is a very important effort that we should all be making. And naturally, we're going to have, again, to come back now, I feel like I'm quoting the song, but naturally, we're going to have failures along the way, but we do have to try. naturally, you know, like naturally, we're going to get it wrong. And I don't think that the fact that we are probably going to get it wrong, you know, 99 times out of 100, there's going to be that one that we need to pursue. There's going to be, you know, that one time, trying to find the one time that we get it right. One of my favorite stories, and it's not necessarily talking about prejudice, but I'm sure some of the listeners may have heard, and you guys may have heard, the story of the old man on the beach who's walking around putting starfish back in the water. Have you guys heard that story? Where there's an old man, and it's one of those sort of Christian illustration stories, but it's one of my favorites, where a man is walking along the beach, an old man is walking along. There's hundreds of starfish along the beach, and he's walking over one by one and putting the starfish back in the ocean. And another guy comes to him and said, look, there's hundreds, there might even be thousands of starfish on here. You're not going to clear the beach of all the starfish. You can't possibly think that what you're doing matters. And the old man stops for a second, thinks about it, and then reaches down, picks up a starfish, puts it back in the ocean, and said it mattered to that one. And I think there's, you know, obviously it's meant to, you know, evoke a certain sentiment, but that idea moves me, that we begin to think that because we can't get there, that we shouldn't even try to get there. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with that. I think that even though we recognize that while we are here on this earth, again, I'm going to talk very Christian right now, but while we're here on this earth, we're not going to get it. But that doesn't mean we don't try. That mm-hmm. doesn't mean we don't reach for it. No, we're not going to get it. Yes, you're going to fail. But the beautiful thing about it, I love the passage. You'll find the more conversations we have that I'm rather poor with numbers and remembering where things are in the Bible. I just sort of know the text.
Makes two of us. But
the passage that says his mercies are new every morning, you know, the fact that they're new every morning means that they're not used up from the mistakes that I made yesterday. I wake up to a new opportunity. I know I'm, you know, made poor choices yesterday. I know I did it wrong yesterday, but grace says try again tomorrow. Grace says you can make better choices today. You can try better today. And you know what? Christ comes along and says, I'm here to help you. And that's part of, it's an aspect of the beauty of the gospel to me, is that, you know what? Yes, you made these mistakes, and perhaps you made mistakes that are so consequential that your life will be irrevocably changed from them. You know, perhaps you broke a relationship that through circumstances will never be repaired. But you can start trying today to make better relationships and to make better choices in the relationships you do have. And I think that's something we should be reaching for. And in that aspect, I was on board with the final speech of Zootopia. This rant great has thought. Been brought to and you from California.
Those are great thoughts. And it made me think of something else I had forgotten before related to that speech. Is one of the things that stuck out to me about that speech on a personal level was we spent this entire movie looking at what causes prejudice or racism. And one of the answers it gives really clearly is fear, right? But bellwether says fear always works, and fear is this thing that that promotes prejudice. Mm-hmm. But to quote another passage of scripture, and I think it's 2 Timothy, but again, not great with chapter or
verses. It's in the Bible.
Either.
Look it up.
It's in the Bible. It's even in one of the T books of the Bible. It's either Timothy or Thessalonians. So it is. It's the verse goes, "We're not given a spirit of fear, but of power. Number one, power. Number two, love. And number three, good conscience." Okay, so. And obviously, numerous places, Christ has told us that we love our neighbors, we pray for those who persecute us. And what I got out of that final speech that Judy gave was, she says, we need to try to understand one another. I didn't even get this as much of, we're going to go and fix the world, and we can do it, and all of that good stuff. Because like Reed, I would have reservations about that. I do have reservations about that we can do all of this on our own, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. That's a much more American thing than it is a Christian thing. But this idea that's couched in there of, we need to try to work together to understand one another, even if we disagree. That's something I think we should be good at and be working to get better at as Christians. And I know I need to work on that personally. And I know I can even think of the church culture that I'm in here in West Texas. This is something that we need to work on to get better at, is understanding those and loving those with whom we disagree in the way that Christ did. Because they are not outside the reaches of God's grace. Because like we've talked about, and like the movie talks about, the only category that matters is in Christ. So that was something that also stuck out to me about the end of the film.
Well, and you both are hitting on these things in this final speech that make me say, yes, this is it. This, or at least this is a big piece of it. But at the same time, I feel like I'm listening to this speech and I'm like, yes, oh, no. Yes, no. Like, yes, you know, like, to get, it's like almost every other word, because she right, she wraps it up, and you know, Reed, just like you're saying, she's saying try to make the world a better place, and I'm like, yes. And you know, Blaine, she's like, you know, we need to try to understand one another, you know, and I'm like, yes. And then her final thing though is, look inside yourself. And I'm like, no, that's the problem.
That's
why all this is happening. Like, so it's like this, like that Price is Right thing with like the yodeler. He's like, you're all the way up the hill, you know, all the way up the hill. And I'm just like, with her, and it's climbing. And I'm like, good idea. And it's like, just look inside yourself. And I'm like, off the cliff. I just fell off the cliff. Like looking to ourselves. And like I said, this is what you were saying, Reed, you know, like we can't do this in what we've been given by ourselves. We're never going to get there.
Right.
You know? And so I just hate this idea. And I feel like I've been nitpicking at this movie all episode, even though I really did enjoy this movie a lot. It just kind of, I wanted the metaphor to be more sound. And when the final line of the movie, like, logically gets me on board and passionately gets me on board, and then the last thing that she says is the answer is actually what I would consider to be the problem. Mm-hmm. It's like cyclical.
Yeah.
You know, we're downtrodden. We hate each other. We only see our differences. Realize there's a problem. Think of what would be better, and then work harder inside yourself to make it better. But when you look inside yourself, all you're going to see is how different people are than you and what you want and how you think the world should look. And then there's prejudice and racism and categories and differences. And then you have to go, oh, there's a problem. And then we have to say, well, how can we get out of this problem? And then we have to say, we have to try, you know, and it just rolls on and on and on. So I want my kids to watch this movie. I want everybody's kids to watch this movie. I want all adults to watch this movie. I want politicians that we won't name again to watch this movie.
Right.
But I think I want it because the same reason I want other people to watch movies that I tend to really like and especially like talking about on the show. It's because it starts the conversation. It doesn't finish it.
Right.
And I hope it doesn't finish it, because if this is how it finishes it in the worst way possible by basically restarting the cycle.
Yeah. And I think one of the things is that it's a big budget film. And so even though it's doing all of these cool things, and like you said, Mikey, really well, starting these conversations, that movie is there for one reason and one reason only, in the minds of the studios at least, and that is to make money. And you are not going to make money if you end the film telling people, you know what, you can't do this on your own. You're going to have to look to something outside yourself. That's not going to sit well. So even though it's doing all of these things, there's still, from a marketing standpoint, has to be those sorts of hooks built in to get people to fork over money to buy toys and see the movie multiple times and all of this stuff. So yeah, it's a great place to start a conversation, but it is still part of a money machine.
Well, do you think like that what's interesting is we're talking about this and like you say like, well, they wouldn't really be able to make money if they didn't present, you know, that message, or they said, look beyond yourself. And then what that made me think of, I don't know why I honestly have not been on a 60s movies kick, but I don't know why that made me think of To Kill a Mockingbird, which also deals with racial prejudice and also deals with that. But one of the central lines in that movie that Atticus Finch says is, you're never going to understand a person until you step inside their shoes and walk around them for a little while. And I wonder, at the dire risk of being completely cheesy, I wonder if the final line had said, rather than look inside yourself, if it had said, look beyond yourself. And, you know, Blaine had said, you know, almost as much as that. Like, I wonder if we would be more on board with the metaphor. And they wouldn't have to be. I'm not demanding that films made by professional studios have to include specifically Christian messages. Like, you don't have to say, look to Christ. But if they had said something like, look beyond yourself and your own experiences, Mikey, do you think you would be a bit more on board for it if that were the thrust of that final speech, instead of look inward, but look beyond yourself?
Yeah, because as ambiguous as that is, it still technically would be more correct.
And wouldn't
simply be, like I said, recycling this cycle of violence.
Right.
So, or this violence of, you know, prejudice or division. Because like I said, I honestly believe, and I think, I don't think you guys disagree, but I think the more we try to be the captains of our own ship, the more we judge the rest of the world by our own standards or what's comfortable and whatever for us, which is why it's easy for us to, you know, vote a certain way or not understand why that other country does things a different way than us, because obviously if it was the best way to do it, we would already be doing it.
Yeah. Well, even the captains of their own ship need the stars to guide them. Like, you always have to depend on something beyond yourself to be able to navigate. And we forget that. We forget that in the cyclone of, I want things the way that I want them, and I want to be what I want to be. We forget that, as the old Bob Dylan song says, you're going to have to serve somebody. Somebody that you're going to have to follow, that you're going to have to lean on. And I think it's vital to put that as a part. If we're trying to live out the message that we believe Zootopia is saying, I think that's a vital component, is recognizing like, you're not going to be able to do it by simply mandating for yourself when you get up every morning that I'm going to just do this. You're going to need to look beyond yourself, whether that's to your neighbors, to your friends, if you're churchgoers, to your church community, or if you are in any other situation, to Christ. And you're going to have to look beyond yourself if you're going to be successful at it.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all in favor of your rewrite, Reed.
So, thank you.
I feel like you should have got a little coinage from that, and they should have paid whatever that price was. But
thank you.
With that said, we're to that point where we're going to need to kind of run through our wrap up. We've had a lot of great discussion, but to be sensitive to the listeners, we don't want to be here all day, though we obviously could be. So to start wrapping up, and Blaine may have already played his cards on this one. We start with come on moments, the things that just don't sit right with us. And Blaine, I know you said this, the final speech kind of probably would have made your come on moments category, but is there anything else that you wanted to include in that?
No, I guess I would just reemphasize that for me, it's not the final speech necessarily because of some of the problematic elements that may be there, but it's just that I'm not a fan of final speeches as a way to wrap things up, or I guess maybe even the concert at the end.
Yeah,
it's kind of a cute thing to roll in the credits, for it to be kind of tacked on right before the credits start,
could have
been without it.
It's like double credits except without the credits.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Reed, how about you? What did you not like about this film?
Well, the come on moment for me might be perhaps a bit pretentious, but the come on moment for me was we said we were going to spoil everything, and we so far avoided this spoiler, but now I'm just going to go ahead and dive in for it. The final fake out in the pit when Nick Wilde and Hops finally uncover the villain. That's not giving too much away. That moment when they finally uncover the villain of the piece and capture them. I was sitting there the moment that it happened. I was never in suspense about that moment because
not even a little bit.
They had emphasized those blueberries like four times already. And I was like, this movie is not about blueberries. Those blueberries are going to come into play somewhere in the film. And so, you know, by about the fourth time that they, you know, referenced the blueberries, I was like, come on. Like you said, like, we know that this is where this is going. So the final, you know, when the villain, you know, fires that shot that is supposed to be, oh, now things are going to get crazy and, you know, Nick Wilde's going to go feral. I was like, that's a blueberry.
Blueberry.
So I would say that it was probably obvious to you. I thought it was pretty obvious myself, but I think there's something to be said about people who watch a lot of film and study story, because for the same reasons, the second time that the bad person, why am I trying not to spoil things? The second time the ultimate uncovered bad guy was on screen, I leaned over to my wife and I said, you know, that's going to be the bad guy, right?
Yeah.
You know, like it's just because I was like, narratively, that's how it has to work, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like you reveal them in a certain way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was right. You know, so, I think not everyone would have gotten that.
But yeah.
I think there's, like I said, I think there's something to be said. Not that it negates the fact that it still is kind of a come on moment, because come on, try a little bit harder. But right.
Try everything.
Yeah, try everything. But yeah, so I think there is something to be said about just we practice a lot at this. You know, we watch a lot of movies. We understand story structure.
That's so true.
But so I'd say for me, the thing that just didn't do it for me is actually the thing that made me want to not see this movie in the first place. And that is some of the gags I just didn't find that funny. And since the entire trailer, like, I had no idea what this movie was about. And I probably wouldn't have gone and seen it if one Blaine hadn't told me he saw it like 36 times. And like bootlegged it so he could watch it like on his phone or whatever. And
not true. For the record.
And then you know, it was getting really great reviews, and I was like, I have no idea what this movie's about. All I know is there is a DMV sloth scene that I do not find humorous at all. And I apparently am in the minority, because even though I watched that trailer many times and did not find it amusing, and I know that anyone who saw a trailer for Zootopia saw that scene, or at least the majority of that scene, there was a guy behind us in the theater, and I thought he was going to die. Like, I really thought he was going to die, because there was, like, snorting and cackling and, like, foot stomping. And I almost couldn't hear the screen because he was like crying, laughing. And I was like, but you've had to have already seen this. And it's still this funny. This isn't like a Naked Gun movie. This is like mild comedy. So some of the gags just didn't work for me as much as they did for other people. I kind of wish they had, because I feel like I'm missing something, but that and like, the gags that they would have with Clawhauser, being like the donut eating cheetah, the slow fat mm-hmm. cheetah. Like I realized they were setting story wise, they were setting him up to be something that we're gonna feel pity for later. But yeah. Most of the things I thought he would did that were supposed to be like funny, I just didn't find that funny. So I'm just a curmudgeon. I think the theology's bad. I don't think it's funny. Why do I even like this movie? God, I'm such a jerk.
You didn't find Clawhauser putting the head on the top of a quasi, you know, Shakira gazelle hilarious? I hope you can hear my sarcasm.
But. Oh yeah, I was like, I don't get it. Like, I was like, oh, this is like when I see people post on Facebook and they've done like the face swap thing and I'm supposed to think it's the funniest thing in the world. And I'm like, well, that was a waste of my time.
Yeah. Which skin, I mean, crawl at best.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I would say the irony being that I'm on Facebook in the first place thinking I'm not wasting my time. But so, you know, it's like, that's that third person realization kind of thing. But we switch gears and we all enjoy this movie. So we probably have plenty of favorite things to talk about. So Blaine, what were some of your favorite moments?
Well, I mentioned earlier that one of the things I like about animation is that it's fun. So this is just something fun that I liked. Nothing profound. But I loved the opening scene and the little play they do.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I've watched it, I've laughed uncontrollably when she does the blood, more blood, and then grabs the ketchup and everything. And I think it's because I have a really dark sense of humor. And so I love that part. And then, of course, it sets up the sort of bookends for the film where they return to that scene later on, mm-hmm. shooting the blueberries down in the little thing. So
yeah,
I love that scene. And when she squirts the ketchup, it and seeing her parents' reaction cracks me up. Especially because it feels kind of wrong to laugh at, because it's a fairly dark thing in a kids' movie.
Yeah.
Probably a big part of why I thought it was so funny too.
Or even a kid's play in a kid's movie.
Right.
Cool. Reed, what did you have?
Well, so here's where I certainly hope that I don't detriment our friendship, but actually I had not seen a trailer. I had actually gone into Zootopia with nothing more than the little coming soon icon on IMDb, and I just knew, like, oh, okay, this is, you know, Rotten Tomatoes gives it a 99%. Hadn't seen a trailer, hadn't seen a thing about it, so please forgive my poor parenting skills, but we just took our son to see it. And so, you
you're
know,
the worst.
Hadn't seen a thing about what it was about. So for me, I have to be honest that the sloth scene was hysterical.
Sitting behind me in the theater?
Okay, so confession, we were in North Carolina. I have stalked you a little bit, and no. Just
well, full confession, the only reason that disappoints me is because you didn't tell me.
But no, I really, I did find it clever, keeping in mind that maybe, I mean, just sort of in fairness to the whole disagreement, maybe had I seen it in every trailer, I might have been tired of the joke by the time I went into it, but that was the first time I was seeing it. So I was like, that is pretty clever. And I did find it amusing. I wouldn't say I, you know, snorted blood cackling about it, but I, you know, like I definitely thought that was hilarious. And I thought it was probably a highlight of the jokes. I actually found that the film didn't have, I do agree with you, Blaine, that I thought the film was fun, but it did not have as much funny jokes expected it to have. It just didn't. There were a few puns here or there, but, and that's actually something that's sort of my final loved thing. I'm a sucker for horror films and suspense films. So the components of the story that were more mystery in nature and a little suspenseful, I loved that. You know, that's the part of me that got really excited, like, oh, this is great. You know, they're blending this element in, and obviously it's not going to go too far because it's a kid's movie, but I loved that they incorporated those elements just because that's my favorite genre. So I did find the sloth scene hilarious, I'm sorry to say, and I thought that the components of suspense and mystery were really, really thrilling.
I think the part of the sloth scene that I enjoyed the most is twofold. One, what it sets up at the very end.
Oh yeah.
I think that was great. and two, that the only part that I thought was actually clever was if you just watch Nick's face the entire time.
Oh.
He, okay. Like, because, you know, Jason Bateman doesn't have any lines, or doesn't have many, if any, lines. So you're not really listening to what he's saying. But when they keep cutting to the side shots and he's just looking, like, what they do with the animation and, like, the way he's looking at Hop or Judy.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. It's clever to think that they thought, you know, to do all that stuff. So I did appreciate that.
I got to give real quick a shout out to that whole Godfather homage as mm-hmm. well. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty funny.
Oh yeah. Gosh. Oh, so things that I thought were the best. Well, I think most of them have maybe been hitting on except for one thing, and easily quick mention, there was no poop jokes. I love that there were no poop jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
I get so tired of watching comedies and be like, "This is so funny. You really didn't need to go there. We were already laughing." Like,
yeah.
That's cheap. That's lazy. So I hate when things that are pretty smart do that. The second thing is, I really enjoyed the flashback with Nick when he was trying to do the scouts thing, and not because it was particularly amazing, but I like the idea that. It furthered the metaphor, and furthered the idea that we see our villain say at the end that fear always wins.
Yeah,
and so it shows how that affects everybody. You know, like no one's immune from that. It's not just the predators that are doing that.
Yeah, and I know we're wrapping up, but just point out something I found interesting. I guess the original thrust of Zootopia was supposed to focus on Nick Wilde's character and how we got that opening scene with Judy Hopps. I think his flashback was originally supposed to be how the movie opened, and that that we were supposed to primarily follow him through the story, and then he just meets Judy. But I think early test audiences or studio heads said, like, Nick Wilde is relatively unrelatable. This Judy Hopps character is who your story needs to be about. So they shifted it, told almost the identical story just from Hop's perspective, and used that scene as a flashback.
Mm-hmm.
So at least that's what I read about it.
And in the Imagining Zootopia documentary, they talk about that a lot. And actually the first version of the film was much, much darker. Like you said, opening with a scene like that, and the shock collars that predators would wear played a prominent role. It sounded like a really dark film. In its beginnings. And so, yeah, they reworked. This film actually, it seems like, went through a lot of reworking and rewriting along the way.
Well, I think if you want to explore what they explored, you're probably not going to just come up with a single idea and do it right the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So, I mean, that's pretty great. And to end my favorite moments, I would say the thing that I enjoy the most is something that Blaine has already alluded to, but I remember, the song aside, but her train ride through Zootopia when she first got there, I just thought it was incredibly imaginative. It painted this really cool world that I could totally buy into. Mm-hmm. Just like the different types of animals doing different types of things and the different climate zones. And so I was just like, I'm on board. I didn't know how you could sell this world to me, but you just did right at the beginning. Let's do this. So, you know, it made me want a Disney ride that was that, you know?
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
So,
and I would imagine the screenwriter in you appreciated them setting that up so that when you visit all those worlds later, you're familiar with them. You've seen them before. It's not like, hey, I didn't know this place existed.
Yeah. I mean, it does. Thank you, Carr. It does so much, without really, you know, having to have exposition.
Yeah.
It shows how people relate. It shows that how different animals live in different places, and all that stuff, and how these different types of animals just could find homes, and sets up the districts, and, you know, how hers is going to be a little bit different and things like that. And, you know, I just think that's cool. So with that said, any final thoughts that you had, Blaine?
No, I'll leave it there.
Done.
Yeah.
Blaine says go see it because right now he's giving it most of the money.
This is true.
Reed, anything?
No, I'm not bootlegging it, guys.
Definitely not. Yeah, so Reed, did anything that you wanted to, any final thoughts, anything that you wanted to add
in? No, I think we've covered all the highlights of most of what the movie made me, you know, made me feel and think. I do, you know, just to reiterate, I'm glad that the conversation's happening and that it's, you know, that the film's out there. And yeah, I do think it's something that is worth seeing. Even if you already know this is what it's going to be about, this is the, you know, place that they're going to land. I think it's a worthwhile movie. It's got rich animation. You know, it's well structured, and I really enjoy it. I think it's a worthwhile film.
Yeah, I would also end with the fact that I think it's a solid film, and like Reed's talked about, I'm kind of glad it exists. I can't wait to like watch it with my children. I can't wait to have conversations with them about it. And I love this moment that my wife and I had when we went to see it, where the credits were rolling, and I didn't even have a chance to ask my wife if she liked it. I just the credits were rolling, and all of a sudden it was like executive producer John Lasseter, and Laura goes, "Oh, okay, that's why." And we both knew that meant like that's why we both liked it so much. You know, so we're like, good job, John Lasseter. John Lasseter strikes again. So
true.
You know, because you know, with very, very, very probably one or only two exceptions, that's a safe bet. So, with that said, I think we've had an amazing conversation personally.
I agree.
So I would love for anyone else who has enjoyed listening to the things that Blaine you've said or Reed that you said, be able to continue these conversations with you guys. One way to do that is to do it through our Facebook discussion group. So if you are not a part of that Facebook discussion group, the Real World Theology group, please find us on Facebook and join that group. Almost everyone who's ever been a part of Real World Theology is a part of that group. So if you want to start a conversation, do that. But there's other ways to find these guys. So Reed, how can people follow the things you do or incite conversation with you around the interwebs?
Well, definitely in that group. And also, you can look on morethanonelesson.com. One of the co-hosts for that podcast and do a frequent bit of writing for them. And then also I am on the Twitters at Reed Lackey. And then, you can just generally find me around. I do have a website, but I'm in the process of reconstructing it. But if you want to go check out some other things that I've written and done, you can go to reedlackey.com too.
Awesome. Same thing, Blaine. How can people find what you're doing?
You can find all of the things or most of the things that I write on Real World Theology. You can listen to my podcast, read my reviews. And if you want to find me on Twitter, it's DEPT_of_tourism. And I tweet links to other places I write and random thoughts there.
Awesome. So as always, guys, you can follow me at Physification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. Please do that. Subscribe to the podcast. Keep going to realworldtheology.com. And look for our guests, look for all the notes for this show where you'll find their contact information, because they were excellent guests, and I think they would be more than happy to continue these conversations if you just reach out. Don't be shy. They won't bite much. I don't know. You know, what do you say? You don't bite. So give them a shout out. Let them know what you liked about the show. Let them know what you liked about the things they had to say. And we're always grateful for them. Are also grateful for you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember, guys, that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo! Boy, Reed sure does love Jesus, but he needs some soap in that mouth. Good Lord.
Oh, gosh.
That's funny.
Can that be the outtake, Mikey?
Yes.